Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of this program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Raw Deal, right here on Revolution Radio, this 8th day of January, 2024. I have a fabulous guest for you today, a Palestinian Christian woman who knows the case inside and out. She's going to give you insights and revelations you've never grasped before that make a comprehensive difference in your understanding of the situation. Before we get there, however, I have some news to report. Russia is claiming that Lloyd Austin, the U.S. Secretary of State, is dead in Ukraine. Criminal Secretary of Defense Austin was allegedly killed in Kiev on January 3rd when Russian cruise missiles hit a command bunker where Austin and Lieutenant General Valery Zaluhny, a commander of the Ukrainian army, met secretly to discuss mounting an asymmetrical offensive to bring Vladimir Putin to his knees. Claims a Russian FSB source known for providing valuable intelligence and the truth behind Putin's special military operation. The story, however, directly contradicts an administration narrative about Austin clandestinely hospitalizing himself for an unnamed ailment at Walter Reed Hospital. Friday, a frenzied media went haywire after Politico ran an article about Austin admitting himself to the hospital and staying there an entire week without notifying his criminal-in-chief, resident Joe Biden. The remarks viraled into undreamt-of drama engulfing all levels of government, with lawmakers calling for Austin to resign for poor judgment and lack of transparency. It appears, according to them, Putin had bestowed upon Austin the title of war criminal. Putin was delighted by Austin's demise. We knew Austin was in Ukraine. We discovered the rendezvous point. We knew that the pig, Zaluhny, a killer of women and children, was to meet his lieutenants, learn about new drone warfare. They were our intended targets. Austin was a bonus. 20 cruise missiles destroyed service building, collapsed a labyrinth of interconnected chambers, battle damage revealed the strike had raised the structure and cratered what lay beneath. Only rubble remained. Nothing on this earth could survive what we said. Yes, he's dead. He must be dead. I am reminded here of the death of Saddam Hussein and his sons, who actually died in a B-1 bomber strike on a restaurant on the outskirts of Baghdad on the 7th of April, just 3 weeks into the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. He was already dead. They were going to celebrate this with the mission accomplished on the USS Lincoln off of the coast of San Diego. Somebody, however, figured out, and my best guess, Donald Rumsfeld, that three presidents had signed executive orders declaring that the assassination of foreign heads of state was a crime, Thus, if W had announced what actually had happened, it would have been in violation of the law, so they had to scuttle, which is why the whole thing was such a mixed message. He couldn't actually explain what they'd actually done by taking him out. Instead, they took one of his doubles, claimed to have found him in a spider hole, put him on trial, and hanged him. Now, Joe Viles, who is a photojournalist from Australia, was the first to notice that the teeth didn't match, that Saddam had excellent teeth and a regular overbite, whereas the double had bad teeth and an underbite. I confirmed all that. I suspect they made an arrangement and told him that it would be a fake hanging, that there'd be a platform there to save his life so he could wind up in Tahiti sipping Mai Tais. Well, wouldn't have done for him to show up anywhere, so they simply took away the platform and he's dead. Now, Joaquin Hagopian has published, hospitalized Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin's head may roll. Here's what he's writing about it. You can find this on my blog and on the government rag. U.S. Secretary of State Lloyd Austin's hospitalization on January 1st, resulting from a post-surgery complication from an elective medical procedure, was kept quiet. Even senior Biden administration leaders, top Pentagon officials, and members of Congress. Not even Austin's boss, President Biden, knew he was in the hospital. I'll just tell you, this is such complete nonsense. No one should believe it. Indeed, this fantastic story about Austin being at Walter Reed for 4 days that Pentagon's only now alerting the public is an outrage. Yeah, it would be an outrage if it were true. Now, the earlier story came from Real Raw News, which I have found to be not a completely reliable source. But this story is such an obvious fabrication, I find it embarrassing. Here you even have former Vice President Mike Pence say, to think that at a time when we have allies at war in Eastern Europe and here in Israel, that the leader of American military at the Pentagon would be out of commission for a number of days and the President of the United States not know about it, I think was a dereliction of duty. The secretary of the administration, frankly, need to step forward and give the American people the facts. Well, the fact is, he was in Ukraine, he was killed in Ukraine, and they don't want to admit it. So they've been fantastic about it. Meanwhile, here's Colonel, that's my surmise. That's what I infer from this multiplicity of stories you're being given. Bullshit. It wasn't elective. He wasn't in Walter Reed. The man was dragged out of the rubble just as Saddam's lifeless body was dragged out of the rubble. Dick Cheney was even quoted in the New York Times saying that they thought they had got him, and they had got him. Well, in this case, the Russians got Lloyd, I have no doubt. Meanwhile, here's Colonel Douglas McGregor reflecting on where we are today. This is a very wise man.
I think that we have become increasingly isolated over a long period of time. I would not attribute it exclusively to Netanyahu's dominance of the policymaking arena in Washington. We have to go back and look at the last 30 years and the trouble that we have caused in many cases on a regional basis in Europe as well as in the Middle East, to understand why our supposed partners and allies are increasingly silent and walking away from us. And now, of course, with Europe in turmoil, thanks to the economic policies directed at Russia that failed miserably, you add that to the situation in the Middle East where any of the Muslim states that had previously worked with us are now completely unwilling to do so. You have almost a global disaster. Certainly everyone in Latin America, Africa, in the Far East, no one really is pleased with us or the way we do business. And we continue to insist that that's not true, but it is.
Well, can you put your finger on one or two or three causes of this? Is it our unbridled support for Israel and the perception that it is engaged in indiscriminate slaughter? Is it our, going back to George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, view of American exceptionalism? Is it the $2 trillion we spent killing people in Afghanistan and Iraq, supposedly, to bring Western democracy there?
I think you're describing our foreign policy, which essentially amounts to playing risk with democracy. That everything we do is, at least in theory, designed to promote liberal democracy wherever it does not exist, to go to quote-unquote ungoverned spaces and impose order and ultimately liberal democracy. Well, all of these have failed miserably. And ultimately, over time, people say, well, why are you really where you are? Why are you in Iraq? Why are you in Syria? Why are you in Lebanon? Why are you in Libya? It doesn't make any difference. Why are you interested in what's happening in Taiwan? There are no armies prepping to invade Taiwan. There's no interest in Taiwan or China in a war with anybody. All of this revolves around an ideological construct that views the world through the lens of democracy, the way the Bolsheviks viewed the world through the lens of communism. And ultimately, like the Bolsheviks, we've taken a position that anything we do is morally justified. And that certainly is the position that Mr. Netanyahu has taken, and we have eagerly adopted it.
Let's bore down a little bit. Since you and I last spoke, the Security Council of the United Nations voted 13 in favor, 1 against. Since it was the U.S., it was effectively a veto, and 1 abstention on calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. The abstention, of course, was the Brits, who you know better than I will always do what we ask them to do. The U.S. explanation for vetoing this was, why give Hamas a chance to regroup? How does that play in the international arena?
If you look at the actions that are being taken, look at the words that are being spoken, and you are an Arab, a Turk, an Iranian, who lives somewhere in the Near East, North Africa, you conclude the following. All of us are effectively animals, subhuman. We all deserve the worst. And we are in a war today against Israel that is not anything like the wars that have been fought in the past. This is not 1973 or 67. This is not a short-term expedient to either expand the country or, for that matter, to simply have more defensible borders, which Israel has always wanted and every nation state does. This is now, in the minds of Arabs, Turks, and Iranians, a war for Jewish supremacy in the Middle East. Full stop. That's the war. If you are in our way, you die. There's no compromise, there is no negotiation, and there will be none. Anyone who does not succumb to our power, who does not ultimately submit to what we want, is the enemy and will be destroyed. Now, this is enabled by the United States. Let there be no doubt about it. Remember, most of us in the United States, I include myself in this category, are very sympathetic to the Israeli state. We're sympathetic for reasons that go back 50, 60, 70 years. But this is a fundamental change in the way the Israelis have done business in the past and the way they're going to do business from now on. And that's why this war can only escalate. This is not a war that's going to end in a couple of weeks or another month from now. This is going to escalate well into next year, and it's going to be a do or die proposition for everyone involved, especially Israel.
Here's the
I think that Colonel McGregor has it exactly right. Meanwhile, Israel is demanding the U.S. wage war against Iran to install a new government. This is so insulting. Iran may be the greatest peace-loving nation the world has ever known, having not launched a war of aggression against any other state since 1775. And to drive the point home, remember, the Constitution was ratified in 1778. George Washington was elected our president in 1779. So for longer than the United States has existed as a constitutional republic, Iran has not launched a war of aggression against any other state. And yet Israel is telling us we should attack Iran because Iran is a terrorist state. Israel is a terrorist state. The United States is a terrorist state. Iran and Russia are not. Believe me, this is such an historical injustice. In an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal, former Israeli PM Naftali Bennett attempted to make the case that America has a duty to fight Israel's war with Iran in order to bring down their regime. The Iranian regime is at the center of most of the Middle East problems and much of the global terror. Yet, inexplicably, almost nobody is touching it. Almost nobody is touching it because it's blatantly false. It's completely absurd, just ridiculous if you understand history. But sad to say, most Americans don't because they're getting their news from Israeli-controlled sources in the media. Whether it's CNN or NBC or the New York Times, they all have executives, hundreds, who are dual U.S.-Israeli citizens and who put the interests of Israel ahead of those of the United States. In sum, Bennett says the U.S. must do what Israel is demanding by setting a clear goal of bringing down Iran's evil regime, no matter what. Bennett believes the U.S. has a responsibility to take down Iran on behalf of Israel, which is vital for the safety and security of the Middle East and of the entire civilized world. What bullshit, what nonsense, what absurdity. Israel also previously convinced the U.S. to assassinate Iranian General Qasem Soleimani, which was just outrageous. We lured him to Iraq to the Baghdad airport on a peace mission by the Secretary of State, and then we assassinated him with a missile. This is among the most despicable acts in the history of the United States. Meanwhile, Mike Whitney writes, is Uncle Sam being duped into fighting Israel's war? No doubt about it. This week's drone strike on senior Hamas leader Salah al-Ouari in southern Beirut provides compelling evidence Israel wants to expand the conflict. In the last few weeks, it's assassinated a deputy political leader in Hamas, a senior advisor in Iran's Revolutionary Guards, and nearly a dozen senior Iranian military officials at an airport in Damascus. Meanwhile, Dr. Michael Schenck tweets, come on, New York Times. Subheading suggests a regional war could draw in the U.S. like it's being led versus leading. The Department of Defense is very much creating this moment. Don't position it as responsive. It's very proactive. So here we have a New York Times story. Attack heightened fears of a wider war for the Middle East and the U.S. when they're right in there pitching. The war against the Palestinians could not be taking place, as Israeli generals have acknowledged, without the weapons, the bombs, and other artillery shells and the like being supplied by the United States. We are openly supporting genocide in Palestine. If Israel opens up a two-front or three-front war with its enemies, as it's currently trying to do, writes Mike Whitney, then the United States will be forced to intervene on Israel's behalf, agreeing the probability that Israel will emerge as a regional hegemon. That's always been the plan. From 9/11, which was orchestrated by Bibi Netanyahu and Ehud Olmert, with complicity of the CIA and the neocons and the Department of Defense to create a pretext for military force from the United States intervening to take out the modern Arab states that serve as a counterbalance to Israel's domination of the entire region. We have an extension of that program taking place right now in Israel. Here we have Amelia tweeting the fact that Israel feels free to annihilate the Palestinian people while the world watches should terrify all of us. Well said. Israel is trying to drag the U.S. into a war of its own making. It's also right to say Iran and Hezbollah have shown great restraint and have resisted the temptation to retaliate. But how long will that last? They can't allow Israel to pummel them forever without responding in kind, and they can't simply roll over or play dead either. And that's not what they're doing. They're following events as they unfold so they have a better idea of Israel's broader strategy. They're biding their time while Israel moves its troops out of Gaza up to the northern front, where they're going to clash with Hezbollah sometime in the next 2 weeks. That is taking place. Meanwhile, Biden's Sea Coalition sinks as allies jump ship among the Houthi onslaught. The Biden admin's much-touted effort to corral a coalition to safeguard the seas from missile and drone attacks by the Iran-backed Houthi militia in Yemen has hit rough waters. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin had grandly introduced Operation Prosperity Guardian during a trip to the Middle East, highlighting an alliance of nations, including the UK, Bahrain, Canada, France, Italy, Netherlands, Norway, the Seychelles, and Spain. France, Italy, and Spain now have all backed out, opting to conduct patrols under the umbrella of NATO or the European Union, ditching the U.S.-led coalition, leaving Biden red-faced. To make matters worse, there have been a whopping 9 more Houthi attacks since the coalition's inception, despite Austin's stern warning for the militia to cease their irresponsible and dangerous behavior. They have disrupted a significant portion of international shipping through the Red Sea, forcing companies to seek alternative, longer and pricier routes. And by the way, benefiting the United States because the demand for oil from the United States at exorbitant prices has escalated dramatically and even appears to have been the motive behind bombing, taking out the Nord Stream 2 pipeline to eliminate cordial commercial relations between Germany and Russia, which would have turned Germany into a powerhouse and made it obvious that Russia posed no threat to the European nation, meaning NATO's obsolescence would have become obvious, which had to be stopped at all price. The Democrats noted this, by the way, as noted, diplomatic outreach to Tehran has been a focal point of Biden foreign policy, elucidating the administration's cautiousness in confronting Iran. However, this approach has come under fire with calls for a tougher stance and clear warning to Iran that the U.S. military is willing to defend peace and security in the Middle East. A friend of mine has suggested, not just humorously, that the Israeli national anthem is Onward Christian Soldiers, meaning Israel is very happy to conduct wars at the expense of the sons and daughters of American citizens. Meanwhile, to further the point I was making, why hasn't the U.S. secured Red Sea shipping routes? U.S. exports have increased by 1.377 million barrels a day since the Houthis started attacking ships. That's what's going on here. We've even been crowned now the world's largest liquid natural gas exporter as a consequence of interdicting the gas lines. In other words, we're benefiting off of Russia. Here's more. Is a Palestinian war really a religious war or a war to control petroleum and gas in the Middle East? A RAND Corporation leaked document written before the Ukraine war showed the U.S. planned the European energy crisis and economic collapse to save the American economy. Think about it. Meanwhile, we have the odd situation of Indian troops from India fighting in Israel against Palestinians. Check this out.
Hello, I'm CJ Willeman. Please don't forget to subscribe to our show. Now let's get into it. I want you to take a close look at this photograph here. It shows two Israeli soldiers posing in the bed of a Palestinian child they had killed in Gaza moments earlier. It's truly depraved, but murdering children and even babies is what Israel does best. We know this already. But here's the thing. The soldier on the left is from India, and he's just one of hundreds of Indian migrants to Israel participating in the extermination of the Palestinian people. Very few people know that the very first Israeli soldier to be killed during the current invasion of Gaza was also from India. Which brings me to two points of data that the mainstream media has completely ignored while covering this genocide. But Israeli soldiers of Indian origin are not only responsible for some of the worst massacres to occur in the Palestinian territory during the past 85 days, but also they're feeding information about Israel's ethnic cleansing operation to India's security agencies.
Members of the Indian community are taking on Hamas terrorists in Israel.
About 206 reservists have been called for duty.
Their genocide operations are supported by Indian military intelligence gathering efforts, a byproduct of the close intelligence sharing relationship India enjoys with Israel, as revealed recently by the former National Security Advisor to Benjamin Netanyahu.
There has been intelligence cooperation between Israel and India over the years. It's a long cooperation, and I had the privilege of being in it, and I recall visits to India, heading delegations to talk with Indian counterparts and colleagues.
Last month, the Israeli ambassador to India boasted that he could create an entire Israeli army with the number of volunteers he has received from Hindu nationalists in India, who are just itching to kill Muslims wherever they can find them. But let's first focus on the hundreds of Indian Jewish soldiers who are currently in Gaza, killing Palestinians and blowing up schools and mosques while also sharing information about Israel's genocidal methods with Indian military officials, information and intelligence that's helping the Modi regime develop its own blueprint for genocide in India and Kashmir. I mean, it's already been reported that Israel's barbarity in Gaza has become a great source of inspiration for the Modi regime. And we also know the Indian government is studying closely the tactics and strategies deployed by the Israeli military in Gaza, along with the propaganda narratives used by the Israeli government, leading many experts to conclude that Muslims in Kashmir are now in great danger of ethnic cleansing in the name of Indian self-defense. India's genocidal plans for Kashmir were accidentally made public in 2019, when an Israeli diplomat in the United States let slip that India will adopt the Israel model to ethnically cleanse the Muslim population and resettle Indian Hindus.
Because we already have a model in the world. I don't know why we don't follow it. It has happened in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. You have to look at if the Israeli people can do it, we can also.
Yeah.
I think we should just look on there and push our leaders.
And now that India has watched the international community do absolutely zero to punish Israel or stop the genocide in Gaza, Kashmiri leaders are now sounding the alarm. A warning that was given added emphasis last week when Indian soldiers tortured 3 civilians to death in the Muslim-majority territory. The Modi regime figures that if Israel can get away with murder in territory it illegally occupies, then so can India. It's also important to understand that whereas the Gaza genocide has mobilized millions of Europeans and Americans into joining the Boycott Israel movement, the genocide has died.
We'll be right back.
Management would like to take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Hey, everyone. It's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
join Revolution Radio every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Just a couple of short takes about domestic politics before I introduce my special guest today. Former Obama advisor admits leftist effort to keep Trump off the ballot will rip America apart. David Axelrod, one of Barack Obama's former top advisors, is warning that the blatant election rigging efforts would be devastating to the country to remove President Trump's name from the ballots in 2024. I have very, very strong reservation about all of this. He went on to note that if Democrats actually were to succeed in keeping him off the ballot in any state, blocking millions from voting for him, it won't turn out, as the left is hoping, that the authoritarian action of keeping Trump off the ballot would backfire big time, galvanizing tens of millions more voters to vote for him, while exposing just how radical the left has truly become. I do think it would rip the country apart if he were actually prevented from running because tens of millions want to vote for him. I think if you're going to beat Donald Trump, you're going to have to do it at the polls. Axelrod is no fan of Trump, but even he can see this is not going to end well for the Democrats or America. The warning comes after several states have made the effort. They've been rebuffed. I don't believe it'll succeed. The Supreme Court is going to put it down, as even Axelrod is predicting, leaving him on the ballot. But the real issue is that the Democrats are continuing to press forward, trying to remove him. And if they manage to convince moderate voters the reasoning is just, to sway public opinion of the former president through mountains of propaganda, alternatively, what Axelrod fears, these efforts could backfire and actually make Trump more popular than ever before. Meanwhile, another former Obama campaign manager, David Pufel, suggests a way for liberal voters to ruin Trump's chances of becoming president by encouraging them to vote for Nikki Haley during the primary. Nikki Haley is vapid. Trump's nickname for her bird brain is very appropriate. Here we have Fox reporting on this effort. Ex-Obama campaign manager urges liberal voters to support Nikki Haley to sabotage Trump. Meanwhile, we have the revelation. I've been anticipating Gavin Newsom is going to replace Biden. Biden won't be on the ballot. He won't be the Democrat candidate. Between the end of the primaries and the caucuses, they'll take Biden out and replace him with Gavin Newsom, where Michelle Obama is the most likely prospect to be his running mate. But get this, while I've been explaining for years that Michelle Obama is a man, indeed turns out to be a man with breast implants and a huge shaving bill, mainstream is picking up stories like this, that Michelle registered to vote as a man in 1994. They even have the Illinois State Board of Education where she circles under sex M for male. And I believe if Michelle were to make it onto the ballot as a Democrat candidate, the following little ditty would become immensely popular. This is about Barack referring to Michelle as Michael, born Michael LaVon Robinson, and other features evidence substantiating that Michelle Obama is a man.
Men and women of the finest military in the world. Michael and I.
Does anything scare him?
You know, well,
When Michelle's man.
She's a what?
A transgender. We all know.
Oh, my gosh.
Men and women.
Well, my guest today is a woman whose sex is not in doubt. She was a celebrated Middle Eastern correspondent. She has been courageous, intelligent. She is, to my mind, the most articulate advocate for the Palestinian rights and humanity, exposing Israeli monstrosity before the eyes of the world. You've known her as Layla Palestina. Layla, please, I'm so glad for you to join me today here on the Raw Deal.
Yeah, hi, Jim. It's good to be here. I have to admit, I'm still laughing about that video. I hadn't seen the video, although I was aware that Michelle Michael was indeed the dominant partner in the relationship, whatever the case may be. She obviously, or he, it, has not disposed of all of the plumbing. thank you for introducing me as an articulate advocate for the Palestinian people, but it's very selfish. I have lived my whole life having been exiled from the place of my birth in Bethlehem, Palestine. I have spent my whole life praying and waiting for the day when the world would recognize what it has allowed, what the terrorist Israel and the terrorist colonialist British did to my people, to my family, is so outrageous. It has tormented me throughout my life. And that's what caused me to want to become a reporter. And I can later elaborate more on my experiences when I was in Beirut in 1971, learning firsthand. I've spent much of my life in the U.S. and in Canada, primarily Canada, as well as Mexico, and then traveling whenever I could. But I went to Beirut in 1971 to experience what they were saying and to actually begin inquiring and asking of them what motivated them and to watch them in operation. And I had the privilege then of working at the Institute for Palestine Studies. There were some brilliant men that were authors and had done significant research on what they were doing to undermine and destroy the possibility for Palestinians to actually live out their life side by side with the Israelis. Even though, I mean, which sane person would live in a house, have an invader come in and say, okay, I'm going to take over what I want and I'll give you some of it. And yet, after the results of 1948 and all the treachery and deceit and blackmail and bribery and murders that occurred there, the United Nations, such as it was at the time, was doing the service of what the so-called Zionists wanted. The Satanists with their, the terrorist Satanists with their ultimate goal of taking over the planet, but the headquarters were going to be instituted in Palestine because it gave them this aura, this sheen of being divinely ordained, whereas in fact they're actually satanically ordained. But in any case, I lived my whole life thinking, well, I'm going to become a reporter and I'll help to reveal to the world what is really going on. Well, of course, it doesn't take long when you're on the inside that you realize that it's already been taken over long, long before. I was told I never had a chance to actually work on air first in Canada. It wasn't until because of my husband, who was an American, who loved his country. And as a Canadian, I never understood the American fascination with itself and its love of itself as a wonderful, but it wasn't until I lived there that I felt it. I felt what it was like to be in a country where wonderful opportunities, there were no bars to what one could do. The only thing that stopped one from moving ahead was the lack of drive, the lack of direction without having a goal in mind. And as my husband always said, if you want it to happen, make it happen. Well, that was the America that I fortunately was able to experience and feel a part of before it has been utterly destroyed by those who have, like a parasite, as was described in the book that was written by Greg Felton, The Host and the Parasite, the host that invited in or tolerated the parasite that ultimately took over the entire institutions of the U.S., and of course it limited work because I had always been proud of being a Palestinian. I never made a secret of it, even though I've had Jews try to recruit me. This Mossad tried to recruit me, the CIA and the Mossad, when I was in Beirut in 1971. But I of course had no interest because I really was there just to learn. And what I learned, I was shown that the Israelis and the Mossad and a whole bunch, American and British and so many intelligence agencies were using Beirut like their playground. They were all over the place. You didn't know if you were talking to an actual Lebanese, an actual human being, or someone who was a terrorist disguised as a member of the society there, whether they were Lebanese or Beirut or from the Arab world. You never really knew until they acknowledge to you that we want you to come and work for us, join the Palestinian, it was the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, they told me, join them and then report back to us. And then, of course, I said, no, I'm going to be a reporter. And then I quickly got on a plane as soon as I could. And that was in 1971. And, of course, a few years later, not surprisingly, with so many people there tearing the country apart, instigating all of the divisions and then creating the hostilities that might have been there. Everybody has hostilities towards someone else, but it always takes a malicious, sadistic instigator that will find a way to set people against one another. Now, the Palestinians, the PLO, the PFLP, and other groups had fought had tried to find a place from which they could fight for their people. But the irony that people, that most people don't recognize, is that the Palestinians are really at the front line, always have been, in trying to hold back this most recent incarnation of Satan in the form of Zionism and Israel. This fraudulent state called Israel. It's a terrorist state. And I think we now know that. It is so nice to finally have the world recognize it. As one of the tragic victims said in one of the Al Jazeera videos that I saw before he was probably killed, he said, "What is it that the world wants from us? Why are they sitting idly by while we're being slaughtered in the most sadistic manner?" And then finally he said, "What is it you want? 10,000 children? All of us dead?" And then he concluded with his hand gesture from his face downward. He said, "Finally, the mask has come off." But the mask is off only for those who already know. Those, some people recognize it, but don't have the courage. Israel has spent centuries, the preceders, the predecessors of what Israel is today, have been putting their people in place. And one of the first people that's on record as having told them what they are and to get out of his country was the Count N.P. Ignatieff, who was then the interior minister of the Russian Empire. He told them, "You are internationalists, you are not Russians, you get out of here. Do not betray this country." But of course, he was sidelined eventually, and the Tsar allowed him to be sidelined, and eventually the Tsar and the rest of the Imperial Russia paid the price. And then, of course, they did that heinous butchery of the Tsar's family, and then they reigned. They took over. Then they were welcomed into Germany. Germany, who gave them refuge. Every country that has ever given refuge to these preachers, these terrorists, ultimately have fallen victim. And in every country, they have followed the same pattern. They have the money and they plant their people. They had organizations that would plant people all around the world where they could influence the decision makers in the country, where they could instigate civil wars, instigate massacres, and find other people to blame it on, misdirection. The oldest rule in the book, divide and conquer. And these terrorists have victimized everyone else, all those they have drawn in. The most recent example, as you just showed us, is India was always very sympathetic with the Palestinians because they shared the same history of having been under British colonial rule. But it wasn't until this fool, this utter greedy egomaniac who wants to emulate the power that he admires in Netanyahu, when that power is simply satanic. It's not Netanyahu's power. It's not the Israeli power. It's the power that Satan has always been able to enforce on this planet. Operas have been written about it. Sci-fi has been written about it. We're very familiar with it, but this fool, Narendra Modi, has made the mistake of allowing himself now to be used. And of course, there have been Jews in India, but they used to be peaceful Jews. Now they have become exactly what the terrorist Zionists want them to be. Now, the Muslims were always victimized. Well, the Hindus and Muslims often fought with one another because of the hostility of the Hindus towards the Muslims, because the Arab Muslims did conquer and dominate India. So there's always been that hostility. But there were also many Christians, especially in the state of Kerala, where there are many Christians. In fact, they were the only ones who actually demonstrated against the terrorist Israeli massacre, against the victims of Hamas and its people, because Hamas is an idea. It is not merely a number of men or a number of individuals who are active fighters. Hamas is actually embedded in someone like me. If you want to kill, you psychotic, schizophrenic, pathological terrorists in Israel, if you want to eliminate Hamas, you've got to come after people like me, because I am sympathetic with Hamas. My emotions are with them because they have proven incapable of being polluted by your corruption of blackmail, bribery, treachery, and whatever other tactics that you, Satan has always used. You cannot eradicate those who are, cannot, they are incorruptible. And that is Hamas, that is Hezbollah, that is Iran. They are incorruptible, those who are in leadership. Of course, you have been able to degrade and make depraved many of the people within their organizations, just as you did in 1948. And one great example of that is Avi Shlaim, who has a video on YouTube that is very short, but it talks about the history of the forgotten Arab Jews. Because this is where the Zionists were unable to win sympathy. There were many, in fact, the anti-Zionists in Europe were killed by Soros as a 14-year-old. Soros led the Nazis around with whom they were colluding and collaborating. And he told them which Jews in Germany were so-called traitors, but they were actually anti-Zionists. And what the Zionists wanted and Soros was doing for them as a 14-year-old, I don't know what his name was then, but he acknowledged on 60 Minutes with Leslie Stahl when she asked him, did you feel guilty about it? He said, no, because if not me, someone else would have done it. Absolutely. There's always a Satanist, a terrorist, a Zionist under disguise. But Soros showed all of the Nazis who the rich anti-Zionists were. They killed them. Those are the ones that ended up in the concentration camps. They were the ones who were murdered in the Holocaust. That is what the purpose of the Holocaust was, to dispose of the Jews who might resist being drawn into anti-Judaism, which is what Zionism is. It is not anti-Semitic because Semite is a language. I am a Semite. Anyone who speaks any dialect of Arabic or Aramaic or Syriac or any of the modern Semitic languages, they are Semites. This fabrication of a phrase called, or a label, which is supposed to arouse in us all this fear and terror of, oh, anti-Semitism. We have knew, I'd like to say that I am among you, but unfortunately, because of my birth, I was able to stay apart from it and somewhat objective, although I suffered for it, obviously, as a Palestinian, but I always knew what anti-Semitism. It was a fraudulent phrase, but you all lapped it up. And who were the greatest, those who appear to have been their greatest advocates were the most revolting people who called themselves Christian soldiers for Zionism. People like today, it's John Hagee, that funny, that horribly grotesque looking man. But remember Tammy Faye Baker and her husband? She was a bizarre looking woman. They ended up in prison for their corruption. Jimmy Swaggart, remember him crying when he was discovered as an adulterer? Oh, forgive me, Lord, for I have sinned. And they lapped it up. And those televangelists, those Christian Zionists, those tools of the satanic terrorist Zionists, they continued raising money. And not only has America itself sent money, but these Christian Zionists and all of their stupid followers have been sending tax deductible money to Israel. They are largely responsible for those monstrous creatures that call themselves settlers that have now shown what they are. They have revealed what they are, murderers and psychopaths that are tormenting and killing the little bit that is left to the indigenous people, my people, the Palestinians. Never mind that I'm a Christian. They are all one. We are all one people. No matter whether they are Muslims of one sect or another, and I am a Christian and Christians have different sects, whether we are Greek Orthodox, Antiochian Orthodox, Syrian Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, who did establish colonies in Palestine because they were looking after the Orthodox. Never mind all of the different Islamic sects, which, of course, the satanic terrorist Israelis have sought to exploit and instigate amongst them. And they used some of the Arab Jews, the Jews who did not recognize or were willing to be bribed, blackmailed, or terrorized for one reason or another. Because one of the tactics that I observed when I was working in Beirut for the Institute for Palestine Studies, I was able to type up the manuscripts for some brilliant men, and also to type up and collate a presentation that was going to be made to the person who was the human rights officer at the United Nations at the time. And I read what their tactics were. They would torture them. They would take Palestinians and torture them in order to make them spies and complicit, to make them become instigators of so-called terrorism. They would, forgive this horrible image that I'm going to give you, but they would attach electrodes to their genitals. They would kidnap them, cover them in sackcloths over their head that were reeking of human secretion. And they would put them in cells.
Layla, hold that thought. We'll be right back with my special feature guest right after this break.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of a library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. Time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Not giving up. Revolution Radio.
It is no secret that the so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why The Story Behind the Story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Layla, you mentioned the Holocaust in passing. From research I have done and others, of course, it appears those were actually work camps, not centers for extermination, that the total who died there, according to the International Committee of the Red Cross, which recalibrated their numbers in 1993, was 296,081, none of whom died from being put to death in gas chambers. One of the ironies of the present situation in Gaza, it seems to me, is that the Jews, the Israelis, are treating the Palestinians precisely the way they falsely depicted the Nazis as treating them in Germany, except this time it's real.
Well, the reason I think it's so similar is because I believe today's satanic terrorist Zionists are the ones who actually are the architects and engineers of the Holocaust and the labor camps. As a matter of fact, the Turkish, Armenian, and Greek genocides were committed by crypto Jews. They were called the Young Turks. They were nominally Muslims, but they were actually Jews from Thessaloniki. And they wanted to kill off, they seem to have this hatred for Christianity that started with our Lord Jesus Christ and God himself, the satanic impulse. But yes, a lot of them did indeed die simply from starvation and abuse and as workers. Some of them may have been actually shot en masse as you would when you had them all lined up and a bunch of guys shooting rifles so they wouldn't know who actually was guilty, so nobody would have to carry the sin of having killed someone in a firing line. But no, some of them were like that, the mass graves. Many of them starved to death. Some of them may have found other methods of torture, but there were. And the reason I say that is because there is someone that I respect tremendously. I attribute to him a credibility rating of about 80 to 90%, and that is Norman Finkelstein. I have seen him twice when he came to our city to speak, sat We had a group of us had dinner together. I didn't communicate with him much. I was more interested in watching him, assessing his sincerity. And as I've watched him over the years, I have come to believe that if he says there was something of a Holocaust, that his mother and father's families died in the Holocaust, and he referred once, I believe, to gas chambers, which surprised me, because the one thing I wish I had asked him is, were there actually gas chambers, or was it simply from starvation and abuse? Because we don't really have some of the great men, generals and others who did write memoirs and or had biographies written of them. There was no mention of an organized, orchestrated Holocaust. And as one of the callers to RBN Republic Broadcasting Network, Peter from LA, has pointed out, it would have been impossible, logistically impossible, to kill as many as they claim, six many people. Just the concept of providing food and to keep them alive long enough to kill them, which of course doesn't make sense. Why not just leave them? Why transport them? Why put them in cattle cars and transport them and create scenarios for all of the nonsense that they've done? What you're looking at here, first of all, the photographs that you saw of me, that was when I gave up on the industry. I was actually, when I found myself on the cover of those magazines, I felt ashamed. I felt ashamed. And it was shortly after that that I left. I had already filed a complaint against the CBC, who fought me in federal court for 13 years while my mother was dying. The last of my three brothers was dying while my husband was sick for 24 years with chronic concussive disorder, which they had misdiagnosed as a Parkinsonism, while my father was dying of strokes. All of that for 13 years, I was fighting off the CBC and the law firm Heenan Blakey. Roy Heenan. Peter Blakey was the other guy, both politicians. Roy Heenan was on the board of directors, and he was the law firm for the CBC. So at one point, because of all the trauma that I had looking after my family and the trauma that I experienced at the CBC, where I was bullied and sexually harassed, but I won't go into the details now. It's in the court documents. But I will say first that the people in the studio at the CBC and the editors were wonderful people. They were talented and brilliant, but the newsroom was full of corrupt gangs who formed cliques and exploited their positions. They knew nothing about how to put together a decent newscast. They used to do 3-minute stories, and they had this pedantic delivery with a sing-songy approach, and they would go on for 3 minutes on the story. Anyway, today they know how to, 30 years later, they're doing news stories the way I was doing it 30 years ago, and I was told, hey, your stories are too short. Hey, you should slow down. But they seemed to think they were dealing with a doddering audience, but they didn't know how. They didn't have the training that you get in the U.S. that I was lucky enough to get in the U.S. because of my wonderful American husband, where I experienced the joy of working with men that respected me. When I worked in Canada twice, I was harassed sexually. Once at Global in Toronto, so I left quickly. The boss, I went to him to complain about the producer that was sexually harassing me, and he called correctly afterwards. As I look back on it, he called the desk area where the reporter sat, the gerbil farm. Anyway, so he harassed me one day as we were walking across this a field to go out for drinks with a group. When I went to complain to my boss, he took me out to dinner. And then he said, we're going to make you a star. They had a female anchor. At the time, it was some other guy with a name who was not the most attractive man, but a very credible man. Prior to him, Suzanne Perry had been very briefly the anchor, but they said that she was so nervous, you could see her jaw quivering. So he said, Ray said to me, Ray Hurd was his name. He was a South African Jew. And he said, we're going to make you a star. And so the night I complained to him about, after he took me out to dinner, let's go to dinner, we'll talk about your future. Get into his car, and what does he do? He tries to harass me. Next day I resign. I'm not accepting your resignation. We're going to make you a star. So I sent him a telegram and left and went back to where my husband was and called my former boss in Michigan, who was highly respected in the U.S., and I said, I can't work in Canada. If I can even get jobs, they're so corrupt, they don't even know how to do news, and they're so lazy. Most of the people sit around either doing two or three people working on one story and giving it no logic at all. So anyway, that is when I gave up on TV news. Today now, they're worse for another reason, because they're all bought off by the Zionists, but they were at the time too. Anyway, what I'm looking at here is, you know how Israel tries to claim it is its God-given right to claim the land of Palestine because they are from there. So there was this study that was done, and look at the names of the researchers, Kobylyansky, Nathan is the other last name, and then again Nathan. Sound Jewish to you? Well, they claimed, now, can we go to the next slide, Jim? I don't know if that one has the content of the actual study. No, it doesn't. But what it does, it shows one thing. They found that the AB blood type was the most prominent. But it turns out, as you can see here, that the most common blood type, this is a recent study. The other study was done in 1977. The most common blood type in Israel is blood type O. And then at the bottom, as you can see, it says, as such, it is generally safe to assume that most people in Israel have either type O or A blood. So type O is the most common blood type, as you will see probably in the next slide, Jim. Can you move to the next slide?
Yes. The key point you're making lately is that genuine Semites, the real Palestinians, have type AB blood type. And that the Israeli...
It is amongst today's Palestinians. Even on an Israeli website, they acknowledge that most among Palestinians, common blood types are B negative and AB, whether it's AB, I think it was AB positive. Now, everybody in my family is AB, either AB positive or AB negative. The AB blood type, you know how... Hey, the Jews are geniuses. Einstein, who plagiarized from his classmates and his Christian wife, Maleva Maharich, whom he abandoned after he humiliated her and left her with a schizophrenic, violent son. And that's a hereditary condition. It's very common amongst Jews. But look here where it says 68 skeletons were unearthed in Jerusalem and Ein Gedi, kind of critical areas for the whole story of the biblical patriarchs. And they said, according to the archaeological data belonging to Jewish residents of these places from about 1600 to 2000, around the time that our Lord Jesus Christ was born, well, they were ABO blood type, hemagglutinin inhibition test. The blood group of 13 skeletons was undiagnosed, but following after they were able to find viable DNA, they came up with, or viable blood type, they came up with a distribution of almost 31% were A group. They don't say the rhesus type. 14.5% were B group. Oh, but 51% were AB group. And then of the O group, the most common in Israel today, it was only 3.6%. So according to these, as they said in 1977 when this was done, according to these findings, the population to which these skeletons belong must have had a high frequency of A and B genes and a low occurrence of O blood. Yeah, those people are the indigenous people. My ancestors, my people, because I am from Judah. I am from the tribe of Judah. Now, what are they doing today? What did we hear recently from Netanyahu, as he was trying to give a pep talk to his team? Go out there and kill them all. Kill every single one. Amalek, remember what Amalek did to you. Amalek, the perpetual enemy of the Jewish people, someone they fabricated. And what is the recurring motif? The conflict. All of you know about Purim. In Purim, it is a celebration where everybody, children and Jews, all go around celebrating. They claim in a story that's in the Old Testament, it has no religious significance, but it's in the Old Testament, that Esther and her so-called cousin, who was really her uncle, and they were married. But the story that they give, which is really based on a Persian novella or a Persian poem, they distorted it and made it into Esther and Mordechai. Keep in mind, Mordechai means it's the genitive form of someone who follows Marduk. Marduk was the god, the pagan god of the Babylonians. So they totally even jumbled together, as they always do when they create their fabrications, the conflict between Haman. Now, Haman was the man who apparently tried to trick King Artaxerxes, or whatever his name is, into killing Haman, who they say wanted to kill all the Jews. That's what Purim is, the Purim miracle. What was the Purim miracle? That the king Artaxerxes wanted to show off his wife and told her to take off all her clothing in front of his friends and show off how beautiful she was. That's the same story that we hear about Helen of Troy. So they're borrowing from Greek mythology as well. So it's rooted in that event. Many centuries later, earlier, Haman comes along. And Haman traces his descent to who? Agag. Agag, king of the Amalek. Amalek were supposedly the people who attacked the weaker amongst the Israelites who are coming away and making their escape from Egypt. So here we are going back, jumbling up the times. Mordecai and Esther were scions of the royal family of Shaul. Can you put it back to the previous one, Jim?
Sure.
I just want to stress. There we go. So Amalek, Mordecai and Esther were scions of the royal family of Shaul, King Saul, the first king of Israel. When the Jews left Egypt, Amalek was the wealth. Anyway, God went on to relieve you of all your enemies. Blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. That is what Netanyahu was referring to when he was giving his pep talk to his fight. Go out there and kill every single one of them. Several centuries later, after Shaul was crowned king, the prophet Shmuel, Samuel, ordered them to fulfill God's commandment thus, smite Amalek and utterly destroy all that is his and have no pity on him. Slay both men and women, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. And so Amalek descended from and the ancestor of Haman. You are now, all of you who are not one of the satanic terrorist Israelis, you are all Amalek. You are next. What you see happening in Gaza now, get ready. Because if you don't stop them, you are next. Jim, can you show us the next line? Again, Shaul gathered the Jewish people and he brought them back. However, he had pity. He did not kill Agag. And he also left the best of the sheep and the oxen. So Shaul was reproached by Shmuel, Samuel, and Shaul being Saul. So he should not, thus Shmuel then, after he was rebuked by Shmuel, Saul was probably killed, but Shmuel then killed Agag. Agag was able to father a child in the interval between his capture by Shaul and his death, and that child was the ancestor of Haman, who later appears in the story of Esther and Mordechai. Again, utterly, Mordechai being the name of a follower of the pagan Marduk of Babylon, the god of Babylon. So the Tanakh is no mere history. Beyond its chronicles of past events, it furnishes us with insights that can enhance our present service of God. This is from Chabad.org, the Chabad that now dominate all of the different modern creations or divisions or sects of Judaism. So the name Amalek refers to a nation that actually existed, so they say. It also describes a character that is within ourselves. Just as Amalek stood in direct opposition to the Jewish people, the trait symbolized by Amalek defies the very foundation of the divine, our divine service, the Jewish divine service. The Midrash describes the nature of this trait in its commentary on the verse. Remember what Amalek did to you. Those were the words that Netanyahu used as you came from Egypt. How he encountered you on the way and cut down the weakest of you that straggled behind. The Midrash explains the Hebrew word. Unfortunately, I've lost the bottom line. But can you switch to the next slide? I think there's more there that will alert people of how much danger the rest of the world is in. Based on this and Shaul's error in allowing Agag and Amalek's choice herds to live, Shaul did not, you must not transgress God's will. He was an elderly, righteous man, God's chosen, describing, he was had a lofty character. Of course, Shaul was trying to be a good man. Shaul was like a year-old child who had never tasted sin. Poor Saul. So Saul's mistake in dealings with Amalek lay in the following dictates. This is important for us to remember, because what this says here is that you must not listen to your own logic, your own mind's reasonable thinking, and your own conscience. Shaul's mistake in his dealings with Amalek lay in following the dictates of his reason. For example, he saved the herds in order to offer them the sacrifices to God. God's intention. He should fulfill God's intention more completely by bringing the animals of Amalek as offerings. So never mind that. Let's go down to the next line. This rationale, though worthy, ran contrary to the explicit. I'm sorry, I meant in the previous one. I wanted to read the explicit. There is an explicit thing. There we go. Though the name of Amalek refers to a nation that. Blah, blah, blah. No, I'm sorry. I guess commentary on the verse. It is the next one. I'm sorry, Jim. I didn't mean to confuse the issue here. Could you go back then to the subsequent to the next?
Sure.
So the rationale of not, though worthy, to follow your own reason and your own conscience, it ran contrary to the explicit commandment that God had relayed through his prophet, Shmuel. The Shmuel replied to Shaul, Samuel to Saul, to obey God is better than a sacrifice, and it is also better than following your own reason. You defy God when you follow your reason. You must make no mistake. Our service is flawed, for the limitations of our understanding prevent us from relating to the infinite dimensions of godliness. The only way we can connect with these levels of godliness is by actualizing a potential within ourselves that is similarly unbounded. Next slide, Jim, if you can, please. And that is only through Kabbalah. Obviously, they're referring to the Kabbalah, which, by the way, in Aramaic is Kabbalah, and it means to accept. So accepting the yoke of God's sovereignty with a simple, unquestioning commitment, can we establish a more complete bond with God. Kabbalah's oil takes us beyond our limited selves and brings out the infinite godly potential of our souls, which means kill everybody. Kill every man, woman, child. Kill every animal even that breathes. This quality was epitomized by Shaul's successor, David, who describes his approach to divine service in the verse, I have stilled and quieted myself. Hasidus points out that the word domamti, I have quieted myself, shares a root with domayim, which means an inanimate object. In other words, David so far transcended his own natural self to have a conscience and a reasonable mind that it was humble to the level of an inanimate object. All of those he needed to kill, he became incapable of self-centered behavior. So to exercise your conscience and reasonable morality, you're being self-centered. So amending the past, the quality of Kabbalah's Ol is also reflected within the Purim narrative. For it was the commitment of Kabbalah's Ol that brought about the defeat of Haman. And remember, Haman is when everybody goes around cheering, and because they now have been given permission by the king of Persia, but it was actually the king of Babylon, but it was actually, it happened in Shushan in the original story, which is in Persia. But so, for it was the commitment of Kabbalah's Ol that brought about the defeat of Haman, descendant of Amalek. This is alluded to in the description of Mordechai as Ha-Yehudi, the Jew. But it's, the Jew is not correct because the word Jew is a modern abbreviation of the word Judah. And Judah was the people who followed the prophet Hud. That is why they have the name Yehudi. There were two prophets in the region at the time, Hud, which these people followed, and Saleh, which the non-Jews followed, the non-terrorist Satanists, those who were not Satanists followed Saleh. So literally, the word means a descendant of the tribe of Yehuda, David's tribe. But David's grandmother, or great.
Wait, let's stand by. Stand by. We have a break here for more from my special guest today. You don't want to miss. We'll be right back.
Take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Ah.
join Revolution Radio every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
Even the government admits that 9/11 was a conspiracy. But did you know that it was an inside job, that Osama had nothing to do with it, that the Twin Towers were blown apart by a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes, that Building 7 collapsed 7 hours later because of explosives planted in the building? Barry Jennings was there. He heard them go off and felt himself stepping over dead people. The U.S. Geological Survey conducted studies of dust gathered from 35 locations in Lower Manhattan and found elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event. Ironically, that means the government's own evidence contradicts the government's official position. 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons of the Department of Defense, and the Mossad. Don't let yourself be played. Read America Nuked on 9/11. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, my featured guest, Layla Paul, who was a prominent anchor, television anchor, even featured on prominent magazines like TV Guide and so forth in the past, has been explaining the history of the claim for Jews to be the true possessors of the promised land and giving an argument based upon blood type, showing that Semites have AB blood type predominantly and that the current occupants of Israel have type O blood type, which discounts their claims to historicity, which go back as far as the study of skeletons of ancient times who have been unearthed. And he's further elaborating on some of the, what I would describe as mythology that is supposed to substantiate the claims of the contemporary Jews, who, to my understanding, are basically Khazarians and wanted to have Ukraine for the new Israel so that could become their new home, and who, out of frustration in part at the defeat of Ukraine by Russia, are undertaking a massive ethnic cleansing to have all of Palestine with none of the original occupants to steal their land. They want to exploit the gas and oil reserves estimated at a value of $500 billion, where Netanyahu has already signed contracts for exploration with international oil companies, even though he's not legally entitled to do so, where they want to build a Ben-Gurion canal right through the heart of Gaza, and where they want every Palestinian either dead or living elsewhere. They've even been negotiating with the Congo, as among other locations, for the Palestinians to reside. And this is all out, as Colonel McGregor was observing. This is the ultimate battle. And Layla has been an eloquent spokesman for the Palestinian cause, when we have yet to see the full retaliation by the Muslim world, by the Islam nations, and so forth. But I predict is coming, and Israel, I believe, will no longer be a viable state. I expect it is going to be physically destroyed. Layla, please continue with your explanations.
Yes, I think what this further illustrates is the discontinuity of the nature of what Jews, of what the Israelis are today. First of all, it shows how satanic and how evil they are. How they are the terrorists, while all the time what they're doing here is trying to make it look as though they have always been the victims. We are the victims. And they tell you, the world, they're telling the world they are the victims so they can disarm them psychologically and physically so that they are easier to kill off and defeat if they're not willing to be subservient and become servants, footstools for these Israelis, these Zionists, these satanic terrorists to actually dominate every one of them. And they, and as what's his name, Netanyahu, who knows, I can't remember his real name, he's a Polish name, but he claims that they're all one people. No, they're not. And they also screw up the dates and the times, and they get their mythologies all jumbled up. When you're going to lie, at least get your lies straight and keep your chronology right. So the Yehudim, a descendant of the tribe of Yehuda, David's tribe, when he's really a Hittite, whereas Mordechai was actually a Benjamite. No way. Mordechai was the Marduk, the Babylonian god. And that's much. That's a couple centuries later. So Benjamite and a relative of Shaul, oh, he's even a relative of Shaul of Saul. Likewise, throughout the Megillah, the entire Jewish people are called Yehudim without distinction of tribal origin. As I've always said, there were many tribes who practiced monotheism. And then for one of the derivations of this word shares a common root with Ha-Hodah, signifying self-effacing acknowledgement. So you are being humble. You can go to the next slide now, Jim. So you are being humble if you obey them and kill whoever they tell you to kill. Now, this is from a Jewish website, and on the left, you see the Hebrew. What I'm looking at here is they claim Abraham was a Jew. Well, at the time Abraham existed, Judah did not exist. And certainly the province or the region or the so-called kingdom of Judah did not exist. So this is, it's not here. I can't remember. It's from Genesis, might be 25. I'm not sure, but it's verse 7. Look at verse 7. And he said unto him, I am the Lord that brought thee out of Ur of the Chaldees to give thee this land to inherit it. So he is Abraham. If you look up to number 3, you will see, and Abram, first he was Abram, and then he was Abraham. Like later on, it's Jacob who becomes Israel. So Abram said, behold to me, thou hast give no seed. So in other words, he was barren. And he brought him forth, and he promised him, someday you will have many nations as a seed from you, which did happen, but it was the Arabs who actually, those who became the Arabs, who actually became the multi-nations. And then back down to 7, we now know that it is Abraham. And he said unto the Lord, why everyone else is taking over my home and everything, as he says in the previous verses. And then I'll repeat again, number 7. And he said unto him, the Lord said unto Abraham, I am the Lord that brought thee out of Ur of the Chaldees to give thee this land to inherit. Ur of the Chaldees were Arameans. The Chaldeans were a tribe of the Arameans. Can you go to the next slide, Jim? This is the path that he followed. He went from Ur, which was right at the head of the Gulf, the Persian Gulf. Now, obviously, it used to be right much closer, but there were many tribes there, many Chaldean tribes, who ultimately joined with some of the Elam, the Elamites, and the Medians in order to defeat the Babylonians. But this is much later. For now, it is Sumer or Sumeria and Ur. So they leave there, and Abraham follows up to Haran, it's not in this map, and then he goes down to Canaan, or Canaan, as people say in English, but it's actually Canaan. There's the trip, there's Ur right here, goes up to Haran with his sister, his half-sister, Sarai was his half-sister, from different mothers, same father, Terah. Goes up to Haran, and then he follows. He goes to the land of milk and honey that was promised him. Canaan was no desert. It was a land of milk and honey.
But he gets there and there's a famine. So what does he do? He goes off to Egypt where he can be. That's what they all do. They go off to a, to somewhere else, let them take care of us for a while. So he goes to Egypt, then they're thrown out of Egypt or whatever. This is long before the Moses story. But he goes back from Egypt, back to Canaan. And this actually may show some of the return trip. But if you go to the, this just shows, but meanwhile, look at all the nations around there, the ancient times. There's Persia, there's Susanna. That's where the actual novella of Esther and supposedly the king that fell in love with her. And by the way, Esther was the niece. First time I read the story, she was his niece and they were married. But when there was a contest where the king was looking for a new wife because his other wife was too modest to display herself to his friends, as was done by supposedly Helen and her husband. Esther and Mordecai were actually married, but Mordecai said, hey, wow, this is a chance for us to take over and for you to influence the king. So go and line yourself up, go enter the contest. He's going to be looking for the most beautiful woman to marry to replace Vashti, was his first wife. But this is where the novella actually occurred, in Susanna. And then you can see there is Susa, and Shushan is what it would have been called. And here we see so many. There's Babylon, there's Ur, it goes up. The Tigris, it's actually the Tigris, not the Tigris. And it's in the Chaldean name, it was Daklat, which is the name for the palm tree. And the Euphrat, it's the Greek addition of the OS at the end that makes it Euphrates. And Hebrew, by the way, comes from the Ibdi, which means he who has crossed the Ephrata, the Euphrates River. That is what Hebrew means. It means to eat. Ibdi is a man who has crossed the river. And then he goes to Canaan, the land that was then known as Canaan. And here you can see some of the older that you will all have heard of. There was Arabia, there's the Nile River, this is what the modern Israelis claim should be theirs, from the Nile to the Euphrat and Euphrates. And here we have Gaza and Palestine. So can we go to the next slide now, Jim? And here, this shows how corrupt Abraham, he's still Abraham, when he's in Egypt. His half-sister is supposedly very beautiful. So he tells her, I'm kind of worried that because you're pretty, first we'll go to this. And Abraham took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their, and Abram passed through the land unto the place of Shechem, unto Terebinth of Moreh, and the Canaanite, the Canaani, was already then in the land. And the Lord appeared to Abram and said, unto thy seed will I give this land. So we're supposed to believe that God disregards these human beings, these people of Canaan, who were not one people. They were many, many people who had migrated there from all over the region, if not all over the further north, east, and west. And he said, and I will, and he builded there an altar unto the Lord. Can you go to the next slide, Jim? Now here, as after he was in Egypt, we all know the story that the Pharaoh supposedly considered Sarai, Abram's wife, so beautiful, he took her into bed as one of his concubines. And Abram, to save his own self from being injured, he told her, please tell him you're only my sister. Don't tell him that you're my wife. And then eventually the Pharaoh finds out and he criticizes him. But instead of punishing him, he has his guys take him to the border and go away. But then he does the same thing when he goes to the land of Abimelech in the Negev. Then Abimelech called Abram and said unto him, What hast thou done to me, wherein I have sinned against thee, that thou wrought on me and my kingdom a great sin? Thou hast done deeds. And what did he do wrong? He told him that, and Abraham, by now he's Abraham, says, because I thought, surely the fear of God is not in this place, and they will slay me for my wife's sake. So I lied to you and said that she was my sister. And moreover, she is in, now look at this, verse 12. Abraham is speaking to Abimelech of the Negev, the Canaanite, the wicked, wicked Canaan. And moreover, she is indeed my sister, the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother. And so she became my wife. And it came to pass when God caused me to wander from my father's house, that I said unto her, this is thy kindness, which thou shalt show unto me at every place whither we shall come. Say of me, he is my brother. So Abimelech took sheep and oxen and men servants and women servants and gave money, gave them all to Abraham. And he gave money to Sarah to preserve her dignity. She had already been taken by the Pharaoh. She was used there sexually. Makes you kind of wonder about the morality of these people. And, oh, we had them in the wrong order. Okay, that was my fault. Sorry, Jim. So here we see that, we're still here. This is where the Pharaoh says, why saidest thou she is my sister, so that I took her to be my wife? Now therefore, behold, take thy wife, take her and go thy way. And Pharaoh gave men charge concerning him, and they brought him on the way, and his wife and all that he had. So the Pharaoh didn't even punish him. Abraham was afraid for no reason. In fact, the Pharaoh was angry. You made me commit a sin and sleep with your wife because you said she was only your sister. And in the previous slide that we saw, they did the same thing with Abimelech in the desert. So now we can go to the next slide. This just shows, this again is just another website, again, a Jewish website. I think it's also Chabad. As you can see, the Hebrew is on, or the Aramaic that they call Hebrew is on the left. And these are the generations of Terah, who got Laban, and he married, and Terah, his father, in the land of his birthplace, in Ur-Kasdim. Ur-Kasdim is Ur of the Chaldeans. And Terah took Abram, the son, and Lot, the son of Abraham, on his way, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, the wife of Abram, his son, and they went out with them from Ur-Kasdim, and to the end they came unto Haran, and they dwelt there. So we've already seen that slide. I'm sorry, Jim, I had them in the wrong order. They went from Ur of the Kasdim up to Haran, and then back down to Egypt, and then back down. So,
Layla, as I understand your argument, you're suggesting there aren't even biblical justifications for the claims of the Jews of Palestine. Yes.
And the way I found this out was I started reading. First, I signed up with something they call the Institute of Biblical Studies in Israel. I thought, well, let me see what they have to say for themselves. And then when I found that they were teaching what they called biblical Hebrew, I was disgusted because I realized they were using modern Hebrew. And I recognized, because this has an audio and MP3 that was done by a man who was of the Judaic tribe. When he read the New Testament, he converted to Christianity. But because he had been part of the Judaic religion, he knew how to pronounce Hebrew correctly. And when these fake frogs from Eastern Europe and Khazaria, Ukraine, which encompass some of Ukraine, or all, actually part all of Ukraine and other territory, up to the Caspian Sea, they were a bunch of renegades who were thieves. They made themselves rich by robbing the trade caravans that went from the east along the Silk Road. That's why they had the caravanseries at night. You know that saying? A camel going through a needle.
Sure, the eye of a needle, yeah.
Once the caravans closed up for the night to be safe, they would close up and leave only a small opening for the latecomers.
and the camel would have to get down on its knees and crawl in through that small opening. All the animals, donkeys, camels, would stay on the lower ground, and above that were places for people to sleep as they continued on their merchant journey along the Silk Road. But the Hazariyas, the many tribes, they were a heterogeneous group, but the prominent people were the Kagan, anybody whose name is Kagan. And it might be Kohen also, because I believe that between the Ukrainian and the Russian language, although it's similar, the H is pronounced in one language as a G in the other. I can't remember which order, whether Kagan must be the Ukrainian and perhaps the Kohen would be the Russian. So all of these Kohens, they gave themselves the name of priest, and the Kagans were the nobles, and the king was Bulan. And their iconography was a phallus, and they were bloody merchants. They were sold themselves out. They were mercantile who would go out and kill. And if a member of the Hazari tribe was sent out to rob and steal from these caravans, if he came back empty-handed, he would be killed, so they wouldn't go back. I mean, if you're going to be murdered, tortured, for not doing your job, you had to be successful or else you'd... Death is so common to them. It is like insects, and that's how they treat human beings that don't serve their... It even kills their own people when it serves their mythology and when they need to provide victims, they take the lesser Jews, not part of the elite. Because what they do in Chabad, the Lubavitch, what made the Lubavitch so successful, I think one of the slides shows that, it actually says that. There used to be three levels of synagogues, one for the lowest of the low, and then the craftsmen, and then the elite. But Lubavitch decided they were all going to come together, and this would have been in the 1700s, starting in the 1400s, and then in the 1700s, it was formalized, and they become Lubavitch and then Chabad Lubavitch. And they joined together, but always the elite would use the lower class people who identified as Jewish. Again, ish is the suffix of an adjective. For example, when I was living in Montreal, where there were people from all over Europe, and I had friends who were Austrian and German, when somebody was asking someone else about me and didn't know my name, they would say, "How was the Palestinischer?" So I was Palestinischer, and the Jews are Yiddishers, because that's what they were known when they came to Montreal. They were all Yiddishers. But over time, because they dominated the Anglos, the Brits, and also the Yiddishers from Russia and Germany and other Eastern European countries, they were all Yiddish. And look at their foods. Today, all of the Palestinian food is Israeli cuisine. Do you think they made tabbouleh and all of the and eggplant and all those other things that are common to the Near East, including the Greeks? The diet of these people was what was common in Russia and in the Eastern European countries. They had matzo balls, gefilte fish, latkes, all those things. A brisket that they would boil in water or in water overnight to make it soft. That was their cuisine. Now suddenly, Israeli cuisine is what is really Palestinian or Mediterranean cuisine. Anyway, are we nearing an end of time?
Yes, yes, yes. We have just a few minutes left lately. It seems to me you made a powerful case that not only is there no biblical justification for the Israelis' claim to entitlement to the lands of Palestine because they are the chosen people, but you made an objective scientific argument based on blood types that these are not even descendants of the tribe of Judah, that they're not bona fide Semites. And indeed, since the Palestinians are, you have provided further confirmation for the point I've made repeatedly that Israel is the greatest practitioner of anti-Semitism in the world today.
You're absolutely right, Jim. What I wanted to demonstrate was to use their own material and to point out to them to those Jews who are being used, who call themselves Jews, and many of them are good people, because they are fighting against what the Israelis are doing there, and they are ashamed. They are ashamed of what they're doing. But they shouldn't be ashamed. It's not, they are just being used. They have been deluded. If you're born and your consciousness is dictated by them, that's why the Israelis want to control this textbooks of the Palestinians. Now they're just going to lobotomize them or kill them. That's all. It's much easier. Just kill them, slaughter them. Make them all terrorists justify it by referring to Amalek and Haman. And there's so much more that there's just, obviously I spent decades, my whole life I've been studying this. I've been listening to people and I've been researching and I have learned a lot. But unfortunately, there's not much opportunity until now. People need to know the true history. They will come. What you see in Gaza now, do you not think you will be next? Who of you? Right now, they're helping you. They're offering you. I speak to the leaders of different countries. They're helping you grab leadership. They interject. Well, they interfere with elections. They choose their people. They appoint their tools and their dupes to run their territories that they someday believe Satan will someday dominate the planet. We have got to stop them. Save yourselves. Save your children. Save, if you believe in God. Save God's planet. Save your brothers and sisters of the soul. Save the Jesus Christ came. That Old Testament was all, it's all outdated. It was distorted, whether it was originally distortions or whether over the years the scribes have done that to serve their purpose, the Zionist Yiddish or terrorist scribes. It's unknown. But we know now what their plan is. And what you see now, the tragedy, the painful tragedy that we're all observing, we have got to stop it. Stop it. And then save yourselves. Save yourselves.
Layla, you have confirmed my judgment about your eloquence and your passion in defense of the Palestinian people. And we know Netanyahu declared in 1990 that America is the golden calf, that we're going to suck it dry and chop it into parts and leave it as the world's largest welfare state, because that's what we do with nations we hate. They want America to fight their wars. Now they're trying to entrap us into a war against Iran. It will not work out favorably, and I anticipate the destruction of Israel is in the not-too-distant future. I can't thank you enough for coming on the show today. Your final thought.
Yes. America, you have nothing to be ashamed of. You were fooled. You were hospitable. You let them into your country and they took advantage of you and they secretly destroyed you and they are going to do more. Try, you've got to somehow save yourselves. You are God's children. Save yourselves. I'm not doing this just for the Palestinians. Yes, of course, I'm self-interested. But I, as a Palestinian who believes in the words of Jesus Christ, thank God I've restored my faith. One of Ron Avery helped me restore my faith. So, and you know who he is. He's an RBN host. Save yourselves, America. You are good people. Do it for God. Do it for the rest of your brothers and sisters under God and under Jesus Christ. Thank you, Jim, for this opportunity.
Layla was simply sensational. And I say to our audience, spend as much time as you can with the people you love and care about. Don't waste a precious moment. Literally, we do not know how much time we have left. And I'm so grateful to Revolution Radio and RBN for being true channels and bastions of freedom of speech, well illustrated by the presentation today by a woman widely known as Layla Palestina for all the obvious reasons. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Recording stopped.
Layla, I'm troubled that I'm not hearing the
audio.
Yeah, hang on a second.
Closing audio. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it is 1:59, so I think the show is done.
Oh yeah, the question is.
Where is the closing audio?
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio.